Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Problems, problems everywhere. On the program today, J.P. Morgan and what could be its $11 billion difficulties. Health insurance exchanges are having their own issues of the technical sort. And then, well, then there's Congress. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 26th of September. Good to have you with us. This is, of course, the Marketplace podcast. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of the aforementioned J.P. Morgan Chase, went down to Washington today, paid a call on the Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Dimon did. Both men declined, well, they declined to characterize the conversation. But it's not inconceivable they discussed the widely reported fines that J.P. Morgan is said to be looking at over mortgage-backed securities they sold before and during the financial crisis. Fines of anywhere from $3 to $11 billion. Tim Fernholz at Quartz has added up all the fines and legal bills that J.P. Morgan's paid the past 3 years. $17.3 billion is the bottom line. So we called Tim up to talk about that. Hey, Tim, it's good to have you back.
Lovely to be here.
This is an impressive list of infractions and fines and settlement that you have put together for J.P. Morgan Chase.
They have been very busy.
Now, here's the thing, though. Are they an outlier? Are they being picked on by regulators? Why is this happening?
Well, the discussion that is underway right now about these huge settlements of $3 billion to maybe $11 billion, they're not necessarily an outlier. These are the same mortgage-backed securities that you and I have been talking about for years now that basically every major Wall Street bank was putting together. So certainly everyone was doing this is something that J.P. Morgan can say. Is it a defense that will be effective? Maybe not, and that is why they are looking to pay so much money. It probably is not a huge blip on their earnings, but you haven't seen, you know, people aren't willing to change up the management just yet.
But that's the part I don't understand, because Jamie Dimon was hailed and has been hailed as the greatest banker of his generation coming out of the financial crisis. And now here's all these things happening on his watch. Is he actually the greatest banker of the generation?
You know, it depends on how you want to measure that. He's got the biggest bank, so that's something. You know, it's a fact. I think one is in the last year we've seen in the last couple of years since the financial crisis increasing regulatory scrutiny. And even though prosecutors and regulators have not been very keen on trying to put people like Jamie Dimon in jail, in recent times they are much more keen on trying to extract as much money from the bank and the shareholders as it seems that they can. I saw one figure that said basically the legal spending at J.P. Morgan is about equivalent to the amount they paid out in shareholder dividends in the last several years. So you could look at that one way and say, well, the shareholders still made a lot of money. And the other way is they maybe could have made a lot more.
All right. I will set up this next question by saying that we called J.P. Morgan this morning, invited Mr. Dimon to come on the program, as we have many times. They did not make him available. So I'll ask you the question I would have asked him. Is this in total, all of these fines and settlements and legal fees, is it a result of corruption? Is it innocent malfeasance, if there is such a thing, or is it executive hubris?
Can I cheat and say all three?
You can. You can.
You have to say one. I mean, look, this is a Wall Street culture where the key thing is to make as much money as possible any way you can. Has there been hubris? I think absolutely. If you look at the story of the London Whale, and in fact, a lot of this and the reason that I think Mr. Dimon went to meet with the Attorney General today is that he's trying to show that he's learned a lesson. There's been a lot of communications from J.P. Morgan lately saying that they're trying to turn over a new leaf, to cooperate with regulators, to try and, you know, be as transparent as possible. And whether that is just sort of PR or whether that's a real thing, it's clearly seen as a problem within the bank that they have all of these angry regulators trying to extract as much money as they can from them.
Tim Fernholz at Quartz talking to him about J.P. Morgan and its troubles. Tim, thanks a bunch.
Always a pleasure.
In that magic way that Wall Street works, shares of J.P. Morgan ticked up a tad today. The major indices did the same. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On the list of really miserable jobs to have this week, besides maybe Speaker of the House, is working in tech support for the rollout of Obamacare. There are reports of two more glitches with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act today. Small businesses that want to sign up for health insurance exchanges online are going to have to wait a month until November the 1st. On opening day next Tuesday, browsing is going to be about the best they can do. That, sadly, is the small glitch. It's a bigger deal that the Spanish language version of the main website for the federal exchanges, the entry point to buy coverage, isn't going to be working for at least a couple of weeks. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains what could be lost in translation.
Over the last year, Obama administration officials have heaped on the love for Latinos, talking about how important it is for them to sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Matt Barreto, who heads the polling firm Latino Decisions, says delaying the Spanish language exchanges doesn't look good.
So for a Spanish-dominant Latino household to then go to the federal government website and not be able to find that information just symbolically makes you sort of wonder, how important is our community here?
10 million Latinos are eligible to buy insurance on the exchanges, which open October 1st. About 4 million of them are primarily Spanish speakers. People will still be able to visit the government's Spanish website, Cuidado de Salud. They just won't be able to enroll or purchase plans, at least for a few weeks.
Somewhere around the country, there's going to be a computer glitch and the website's not working quite the way it's supposed to.
That's President Obama speaking today at a community college in Maryland.
That happens whenever you roll out a new program.
Jennifer Nandu is the healthcare policy director for the National Council of La Raza, the largest Hispanic civil rights organization in the U.S. She says she worries about the fallout next week.
There has been such a fever pitch around October 1st that there are people who will have expectations.
Nandu says the most important thing is that the government let Spanish speakers know when they should come back. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Senate of the United States spent its day today debating whether or not to keep the government open come next Tuesday. But in the never-ending game of three-dimensional chess that is Washington at budget time, there is another arguably more important deadline looming the middle of October and the federal debt limit. So let's do a little what if here, shall we? Just how creative can Washington get with its outstanding balances due? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has the story.
Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says come October 17th, he'll only have about $30 billion in cash on hand. Sounds like a lot, but Treasury can pay out $60 billion in just one day. So what does Lew do? Steve Bell is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says Treasury would just pay its bills late as money came in from taxes. Say it owes $40 billion on a Monday, and it doesn't have the money until Tuesday.
They will then pay all of Monday's debts. And then they'll start accumulating more cash so that at some point during that week they can pay Tuesday's debts.
Of course, you can only do that so long before you get really behind on your bills. And Treasury writes 80 million checks a month. There's another option, prioritize. Maybe make Social Security and defense payments first. But Treasury isn't sure it has the authority to do that because the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse. Nancy Vanden Houten is an analyst at Stone McCarthy.
Congress decides what programs are funded and what benefits are funded and at what levels.
There's another idea out there, and the Treasury Department might find it quite appealing. Ignore Congress. Ignore the debt ceiling. Economist Paul Vanderwater is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Treasury's other option is just to go ahead and borrow anyway. That would be a very real possibility.
Because the Constitution says the government has to pay its debts. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
A little bit more than 5 years ago, Congress passed and the president signed something called the Post-9/11 Veterans Educational Assistance Act of 2008, the Post-9/11 GI Bill, for short. So far, the government has paid out more than $30 billion in benefits. 1 million people have taken advantage of it. And like the World War II version, the money from the GI Bill is changing veterans' lives and quite possibly the economy. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more.
A good education can be about much more than resume building and career advancement.
Going back to school was what saved my life.
Mariette Kalinowski is a former Marine.
Coming back from Iraq, I was in a very dark place, and I was very quickly spiraling into that point of no return. And if I hadn't had school, I would be in a very different place right now.
Instead, she's here.
I want to start with the Kurt Vonnegut.
Thanks to the new GI Bill, she finished a bachelor's degree. She's now teaching undergrads creative writing while working on a master's in fiction at the City University of New York's Hunter College.
The beautiful thing about human language is you as a writer are trying to redefine the language, find that definition, find that vocabulary that describes what you're feeling.
Some students look a little groggy in the 8 a.m. class, not Kalinowski. When she was in Iraq, she woke up before dawn to ride in convoys manning a heavy machine gun. Her new life as a student veteran continues a tradition going back to World War II. This old informational film explains the original promise of the GI Bill.
Any kind of education and in any part of the country, trade school, college, university.
Millions took the offer. In 1947, veterans made up about half of all college admissions. That helped the whole economy as they got better jobs. Over the years, Congress cut benefits, even as the price of education soared. But as new waves of vets came back from Iraq and Afghanistan, political momentum grew to make college affordable for them. Jennifer Steele is an education policy researcher at RAND.
There was a sense that we really needed to improve the GI Bill in order to make that possible.
Now, veterans with 3 years of service can get state school tuition paid in full, plus money for books and living expenses. A more generous GI Bill means more vets in classrooms.
It's nice to have the peace of mind knowing that you are going to have the ability and the financial backing to go to school and really concentrate on it and give it 100% effort.
Jesse Williams is now a straight-A student, having gone from Army patrols in Sadr City to classes in New York City. He's about to graduate from John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He recently offered advice at an off-campus career development program for student veterans. Williams and others in the group wear metal bracelets, memorializing friends who never got this opportunity.
Take advantage of your GI Bill so that you don't have to work. You know, you're not clocking in and clocking out somewhere.
The true test of the post-9/11 GI Bill is a few years away, when we know how many veterans like these are not just enrolling, but graduating with skills employers want. That's where concerns about for-profit colleges come in. They pull in a big portion of GI Bill funds, yet critics say some for-profit schools use deceptive and pushy marketing and then don't deliver.
When the motive is money and you're selling a product and you're looking to put people in the seats, the techniques are going to be that much more aggressive.
Holly Petraeus of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says some recruiters have gone after vets with traumatic brain injuries. The veterans later got bills for classes they don't remember signing up for. Kentucky Attorney General Jack Conway hears often from vets who say they wasted their benefits and even went into debt at for-profit schools.
Some of these for-profit schools cease to see this as a public trust and instead see it as a source of revenue to fuel their greed.
He led the fight to shut down a website that looked like an official government site but was actually built to funnel vets to for-profit schools. That's one of several efforts underway to make sure all the money goes to helping veterans better their lives through education.
Yeah, he does have an elitist feel, but...
Back in her Hunter College classroom, Mariette Kalinowski is the kind of success story the GI Bill was created for. Far from the deserts of Iraq, she's now leveraging her education to build a writing career. She's published a story based on her war experience, has a literary agent, and a novel in the works.
There's mornings that I wake up and just almost can't recognize what my life has turned into, and I'm extremely thankful for that.
That's the hope of this GI Bill, a new greatest generation, as service members trade uniforms for caps and gowns. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, trying to decide who gets how much.
The rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hey, look at that. It's the happy music for the first time this week. The Dow Industrial's up 55 points today, more than a third percent. Closed at 15,328. The NASDAQ up 26 points, 7 tenths percent, 3787. The S&P 500 added 5 points, about a third percent. Ended things at 1698. Financial shares were down today except for, yeah, J.P. Morgan Chase shares up a third of 1%. Shares in rental car companies downshifted after Hertz lowered its earnings forecast because travel spending is down. Hertz off 16% today. Speaking of cars, Tesla shares were up almost 2% on word the company's sedans will be part of rental fleets here in California. $500 a day, I heard. Bonds down, the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.65%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to host a meeting with the Prime Minister of India. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for August, and it's World Tourism Day. Currently, a popular tourist destination is Albuquerque, or Belize, depending on your preference. But everything is about to end. Tread lightly. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Now that Twitter is going to be a public company, at some yet undetermined point, true, but now that it is going to be public, it's going to have to show that it's serious about making money. As social media is currently conceived, that means advertising, most likely, which gets us to the company's announcement that it struck a partnership deal with the National Football League. It's the latest in a series of arrangements that Twitter's made with networks and big league sports, and it helps get them into the big bucks world of television advertising. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
Twitter is trying to capitalize on the second screen effect. You know, when people are tweeting and hanging out on Twitter while they watch TV. It happens all the time now, during award shows, TV movies, and sporting events.
Sports are always, and particularly football, is always a high-quality, high-demand advertising opportunity.
Jim Nail is an analyst for Forrester Research. In the past few months, Twitter has struck deals with CBS, Viacom, ESPN, and others. And while the NFL partnership is new and untested, Nail says it could help prove to investors that Twitter is serious about making money.
Having a big partnership announced like this as as they move into that pre-IPO period has got to help their offering.
The NFL deal is part of Twitter's Amplify service. It runs video clips with ads in them. For example, during this year's NBA playoffs, the NBA tweeted short videos of game highlights that included ads from companies like Taco Bell and Sony. But Brian Weiser, an analyst with Pivotal Research, says you have to remember that Twitter is still a relatively small company.
Let's keep our sense of scale in check here. Google can generate $50 billion of revenue in advertising. Facebook can do $5 billion. Twitter is closer to $500 million. That is what it is.
He says when you look at Twitter's ambitions and growth, keep its size in mind. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
From Stanford University, hard by Silicon Valley, comes news of a breakthrough that could make computing faster, cheaper, and more energy efficient. Silicon has been the basic material of computer electronics for decades. Now, though, comes carbon nanotubes, little carbon wires so small that 4,000 of them can fit in the width of a human hair. They can make even smaller transistors that one day might really speed up laptops and smartphones and whatever comes after them. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports now on what could be the first step in taking the silicon out of Silicon Valley.
A laptop today would have been considered a supercomputer 20 years ago. That's because every couple years, the number of transistors that fit in a computer chip doubles. And so the chips get faster, relentlessly. That progress, though, is going to slow down soon.
People are very worried that 10 years from now, we will completely run out of steam.
Kevin Skadron teaches computer science at the University of Virginia. Silicon chips are made more powerful as we pack more circuits into them. But that sucks up more and more power and gets too hot.
The total power of the chip keeps going up, and we can't cost-effectively cool that.
On top of that, we can only get silicon circuits so small before they stop working. Enter the carbon nanotube.
Carbon nanotubes make that problem just go away.
The computer that researchers at Stanford created is very basic and very tiny, only a couple millimeters across, but it works. Subhashish Mitra led the research.
this is sort of the first demonstration that you can actually build something real beyond silicon transistors.
But what's moving beyond silicon transistors mean for my cell phone?
You care about two things when it comes to your cell phone or your computer. You care about how fast your cell phone is and how long its battery lasts.
That's Max Schulicher, a grad student who worked on the project.
And those are the two things which carbon nanotubes improve by an order of magnitude.
But longer-lasting phone batteries is thinking small, says Sherrod Malik, who teaches electrical engineering at Princeton.
If we do this right, we should see not just future smartphones, but something which we can't even imagine today.
But don't expect Siri to turn into HAL anytime soon. It'll take a decade at least for this to reach consumers. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you flip through the University of California Berkeley course catalog, online or hard copy, you might eventually happen upon Public Policy 103. It's a four-credit course called Wealth and Poverty, taught by a guy that regular listeners to this program are going to be familiar with.
I want you to test your assumptions. If possible, I want to shake your assumptions a little bit about why the system works as it does.
Robert Reich, for those who might not recognize the voice. Bob and that class and the whole idea of wealth and poverty in this country and the gap between them are the subjects of a documentary film that opens tomorrow. It's called Inequality for All. Bob, it's good to talk to you again.
Well, good to talk to you, Kyle.
You have to have some inequality in a society, don't you?
Of course. You know, you need inequality to provide the incentives for people to work hard and to invent and innovate. The issue is, when do you reach a point where the degree of inequality, the concentration of income and wealth and opportunity and political power at the top, starts hurting your economy and hurting your entire society? And I think we're getting to that tipping point very rapidly.
Well, actually, I mean, I think in the film you pretty much make the point that we got there and it's past that and it's time to do something.
Well, we have to do something. I mean, I think that one of the big reasons that the economy is in such an anemic state is that so much income and wealth has been going to the very, very top, small number, that the vast middle class and everybody aspiring to join the middle class simply don't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going anywhere near full employment and no longer can borrow.
Yeah, see, now you're talking like an economist. Lay it out for me in English. Would you? Why does the middle class matter?
Well, 70% of all of the economic activity in this country comes from consumer purchases. Without the middle class having enough money in their pockets to turn around and buy stuff, then businesses are not going to create more jobs. Businesses are not going to expand. We're not going to see economic growth.
It seems to me a fundamental question, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to take wealth away from top income earners short of massive changes to the tax code, which won't go anywhere. So how do you build wealth in this country, Bob? How do you build it from the bottom up?
This is not a zero-sum game in which the only way the middle class and the poor can do better is by taking away from the rich. This is not a matter of redistribution. I mean, the rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than a large share that they have now of an economy that's barely growing because most America no longer has the purchasing power to keep it going.
Where'd this idea for this movie come from?
Came from the director, Jake Kornbluth, a young director who came to me about 2 years ago and wanted to do a movie about widening inequality. And I thought he was a little crazy. I humored him. He basically said, well, this is not going to be a big deal. You just teach your class and we'll follow you around and we'll build a film, a serious movie, which is entertaining as well, hopefully.
You know, it is entertaining and you are an entertaining guy and you are dynamic and fun to listen to. But, Bob, I have to tell you, this movie is depressing as hell.
Oh.
No, it is.
No, it's not that.
It is.
Well, I'm not depressed. It's uplifting. I mean, look, I say very explicitly in the film, if you look back in American history, there are times when capitalism gets on the rails. And unlike many other countries that fall into communism or socialism or fascism historically, we have reformed capitalism. We've saved capitalism from its own excesses. I mean, we are reformers at heart.
So here's a heretical thought. Is it entirely possible that given the way the global economy is changing, the days of a large stable middle class in this country and in the world, perhaps, are just over, and we're going to have to find another paradigm.
I think a large and growing middle class is vital to our economy. It's vital to our democracy. If we lose it, we are going to be in trouble. Our children and our children's children are going to be inheriting something, both in terms of the economy and our democracy, that we just don't want.
Robert Reich, the film is called Inequality for All. Bob, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which Bill Gates finally comes clean about something his company has forced millions of people to do countless times a day. Gates did a talk last week at Harvard during which he was asked this question.
Why, when I want to turn on my software and computer, do I need to have three fingers? Control, Alt, Delete. What is that? Where is that from? Whose idea was that?
So Gates got technical for a minute, something about accessing the base level of the software or something. And then, well, you listen.
We could have had a single button that the guy who did the IBM keyboard design didn't want to give us our single button. And so we programmed to the level that you had to do. It was a mistake.
Blame an IBM. Nice, Bill. Nice. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.